Mark Joseph Stern is attorney, now a journalist. He covers courts and the law for Slate.com. Can you hear me, sir?
Yes. Can you hear me?
We can. We appear to have straightened the problem out.
Excellent.
I wanted to first ask you about the case you wrote up last night to try to explain how Brett Kavanaugh might behave as a Supreme Court justice on some of the hot button issues that will be subjects of his confirmation hearing. You specifically dug into a case called Garza versus Hargan, where he weighed in on whether the federal government had to release an immigrant minor who was in custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement who wanted to terminate a pregnancy.
Yes, that's right. Just want to make sure you can still hear me now.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So this is a really interesting and kind of disturbing case if you're a supporter of reproductive rights. This case involved the Trump administration's prohibition on undocumented minors terminating unwanted pregnancies. So these minors are kept in federally funded shelters, and for decades they've been allowed to terminate pregnancies if they request to do so, and they go through the judicial bypass process in the state in which they're located. The Trump administration came in and said, we're not going to let these women, these girls, really teenagers, terminate their pregnancies anymore because we think they should be forced to carry these pregnancies to term. So one of these minors, called Jane Doe in court filings, she sued and she said, look, under Roe v. Wade, I have a right to terminate this pregnancy and I deserve to be able to go to an abortion provider and have control over my own body. She was instead taken to a crisis pregnancy center where she was talked out of getting an abortion. She said, no, I still want an abortion. The ACLU went to court and Brett Kavanaugh, who is sitting on the panel, issued this weird kind of compromise decision where he said, look, this undocumented minor doesn't have a right to, quote, abortion on demand. He said, instead, what I'm going to do is craft this this middle ground where I'm going to order the government to try to place her with a sponsor who will then allow her maybe to get an abortion. And this has to happen within the next 2 weeks. And if it doesn't happen by then you guys can all come back to court and argue this case all over again. Now, is that at this point, Jane Doe was 16 weeks pregnant. She was in Texas, which bans abortions after 20 weeks. This process of locating a sponsor for an undocumented minor can take weeks or months. And so what Kavanaugh essentially did in a rather disingenuous way was run down the clock or attempt to run down the clock so that Jane Doe would have to keep jumping through these legal hoops right up to the point that she could no longer legally terminate her pregnancy and she would be forced to carry it to term.
So fair to characterize it as kind of using the procedural levers of the judiciary to take away her ability to get an abortion without formally pronouncing she didn't have the right to get an abortion.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think Kavanaugh made this move with his eye on the Supreme Court. He knew as soon as this case landed on his docket that it was going to be difficult for him to maneuver in a way that followed precedent without him becoming a kind of champion of abortion rights, right? The nightmare for all conservative lower court judges who want to get to the Supreme Court is that they'll have to apply Roe v. Wade correctly and allow an individual to get an abortion because that would sink their chances at SCOTUS. So Kavanaugh instead, like you said, pulled these various levers of judicial power in order to maneuver himself out of this tight spot. And he ultimately kind of failed because the full court intervened very shortly after he issued this compromise decision and reversed his own order and ruled that Jane Doe could have an abortion as soon as possible, which she promptly did. So Kavanaugh ended up kind of wriggling out of this without fully embracing or recognizing the legitimacy of Roe v. Wade, but without openly saying, I refuse to apply Roe v. Wade. I think that's pretty much the best that he could possibly hope for his future career.
So on a political signaling level to pro-choice Republican senators like Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, that is perhaps enough political cover to say, I will not be voting to confirm a justice who will overturn Roe v. Wade when I vote to confirm Brett Kavanaugh, but enough signaling to the right to say, I'm going to do everything I can to make abortions hard to get.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think it shows you how Kavanaugh plans to hollow out Roe v. Wade once he's on the court, right? There are many ways that the Supreme Court can basically abolish the right to abortion access without acknowledging that it's overturning Roe v. Wade. And one of the ways it can do that is by expanding the definition of what constitutes an unconstitutional burden on abortion to the point that there's no such thing as a law that really truly violates Roe v. Wade. And so, for instance, the court could say, well, if a law shutters every single abortion clinic in the state and bans abortion after 6 weeks, well, that's not an undue burden because a woman could still cross state lines and go elsewhere, or she could get an abortion in her first 5 weeks of pregnancy. And I think Kavanaugh is very much on board to play games like that. It's disingenuous, but it gives the court cover to pull back Roe v. Wade to the point that it basically doesn't exist without incurring the political fallout that would certainly happen if it just said, we are killing Roe v. Wade off once and for all.
So, Mark, Kavanaugh is a longtime member of the D.C. Republican establishment, conservative Republican establishment. And one of the ways he's made a name for himself in the D.C. Circuit Court is by taking a hard stand against Obama-era attempts at increasing regulations through the Environmental Protection Agency. Can you talk about some of those rulings that he's made?
Yes, and this is really critical because Justice Anthony Kennedy, who Kavanaugh will replace, tended to support environmental regulations. He provided the fifth vote during the Bush era to compel the EPA to regulate carbon dioxide and other fossil fuels as pollutants. Kavanaugh takes an extremely different stance on this stuff. The Obama administration passed a number of rules that were designed to prevent upwind and downwind pollution across state lines. So to prevent Michigan from creating all of this pollution that ends up flowing to its neighbors to the south. And Brett Kavanaugh voted to block those regulations and a number of other Obama-era regulations under the theory that the EPA had exceeded its statutory power, that Congress had never intended the EPA to implement rules this sweeping. What's interesting is that Kavanaugh ended up getting reversed at the Supreme Court by none other than Justice Antonin Scalia, who was still sitting at that time. He, too, is very, very conservative, not at all an environmentalist, and a skeptic of Obama's regulatory power. But even Scalia recognized that the EPA had the authority to prevent this pollution that was crossing state lines. The fact that Kavanaugh came out differently shows you he may be to the right of Scalia when it comes to environmental regulation.
And the very first case coming up before the Supreme Court in October is a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service case, right?
Yes, that's right. This is about the endangered dusky gopher frog and about whether the EPA can preserve habitats for the frog where it doesn't currently live but may live very soon because it has such a tiny range at the moment. And there's pretty much no doubt in my mind that Kavanaugh will provide the fifth vote to shoot down the EPA and the regulations here and say, no, the government does not get to preserve these habitats, that is overstepping the agency's regulatory bounds. So this is definitely a topical hot button issue. Not every American may get excited about the endangered dusky gopher frog, but it is widely seen, this case is widely seen as a kind of stalking horse for much bigger attacks on the EPA and other environmental regulations that could come before the court in the near future.
We're speaking to Mark Joseph Stern. He covers courts and the laws for Slate.com. And I want to move on to the most proximate theoretical constitutional crisis facing the Supreme Court, which is the Mueller investigation. And if the question of whether the president can be compelled to testify via subpoena or whether the president can be indicted while serving makes its way up to the Supreme Court, what kind of posture would we expect Brett Kavanaugh to adopt?
So it's interesting because Brett Kavanaugh, like so many partisans who have long sat in the Washington elite, has changed his tune on this topic depending on who sits in the Oval Office. When Bill Clinton was sitting in the Oval Office and Brett Kavanaugh was investigating him with Ken Starr, he did not generally view the president as immune to prosecution or subpoenas or civil suits or investigations. When George Bush entered the Oval Office, with Brett Kavanaugh's help in the Bush v. Gore litigation, Kavanaugh definitely began to view the benefits of broad executive privilege and executive power, and wrote a number of opinions and law review articles and speeches that seem to suggest the president, at least under current statutory authority, cannot be troubled by civil or criminal investigations or matters while in office because it would entrench upon his executive powers. He is the head of the executive branch. Brett Kavanaugh believes in the unitary executive theory, which states that really all of the executive power is located within the president himself. So I think this is a very telling choice by Trump. Whether or not he had Mueller on his mind when he made the choice is unclear, and we may never know. But he definitely gets a bonus out of Kavanaugh because he has in him a future Supreme Court justice who will probably vote to shield Trump from the more invasive questions or subpoenas of the Mueller investigation, and if push came to shove, would probably rule for the president on questions like, can the president be indicted while he is sitting in office?
Is there any theory under which Kavanaugh would, recuse himself during deliberations on something like that?
Certainly, Kavanaugh could, if you wished, say, I was appointed by this man, and so I'm not going to rule on his matter when it comes before me. But the Supreme Court makes its own rules for recusal. It is theoretically bound by a code of judicial ethics, but there is no body to enforce that code, and so justices decide for themselves when they wish to recuse, and no one can force that decision upon them. Absolutely no one. And so unless Brett Kavanaugh has a crisis of conscience and says, wow, I have to recuse for the institutional legitimacy of this court, there's really no way to push him out of those cases. And I think it's probably unlikely that he would recuse because justices don't like to sit out cases. They like to participate. They like to be that fifth vote and decide these major, major constitutional issues. So I think probably Kavanaugh is going to end up sitting on all of those cases and being the judge as the president who appointed him comes before the court.
To what extent do you think that that was the clincher? You know, there was a long list of deeply conservative potential justices who the administration was looking at. And this is what a particularly conservative member of that list. To what extent do you think this particular position was the clincher on getting him the nom?
Well, it's difficult to say. It requires peering into Trump's heart a bit. There are now reports that Justice Kennedy really angled for Kavanaugh to replace him and even conditioned his retirement on Kavanaugh subbing in for him once he left the bench. If that's true, then I guess it didn't really play much of a role because Trump had to pick Kavanaugh to ease Kennedy off of the bench. But if there was a little play in the joints here and Trump had a real decision among the shortlisters, then I think probably he was drawn to Kavanaugh's view on executive power, even if he doesn't view it in the sophisticated terms of the unitary executive theory and Article 3 and all of that stuff. He probably recognized that Kavanaugh's a man who, when a Republican's in office, thinks that that Republican president should have very, very, very broad authority to direct the nation as he sees fit without getting distracted by silly stuff like lawsuits or subpoenas or investigations. And Trump is savvy enough to see that that is good news for him. Trump always puts his own interests first. So I think if there were a close call between, say, Kavanaugh and Kethledge or Barrett, then this could have been the deciding factor that swung all of this in favor of Kavanaugh.
I mean, you go ahead.
Mark Joseph Stern, one of the concerns Mitch McConnell reportedly had about the prospect of nominating Kavanaugh is that because of his years of government service and service on the bench, he has a larger paper trail attached to his name than any of the other prospective nominees under consideration. Let's talk about the next few months of nominating scuffles. What is worth digging into. What are the prospects of a blocking coalition actually coming together in the Senate?
I think extremely minimal, because Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski are not especially sophisticated Supreme Court watchers. If you saw Susan Collins talking on the morning shows last week, she said, oh, I actually think that Justice Neil Gorsuch would vote to uphold Roe v. Wade, which he absolutely would not. There's really no question there. And that means that Collins doesn't see or has not yet come to terms with the fact that Kavanaugh will be the fifth vote to hollow out or overturn Roe. And if she's not there yet, if she has not recognized the clear and present danger that this appointment poses to reproductive rights in the United States, then I don't see a strong reason for her to say, I'm not going to vote for this nominee or I'm going to cause trouble for the president. Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski like to go along to get along on judicial nominations. They have voted for every single one of Trump's previous lower court nominees, as well as Justice Gorsuch. So I don't see why they would change their tune now and decide to put up a fight when, if anything, Kavanaugh's probably a little bit more moderate than Gorsuch.
Do Democrats have any procedural room to slow it down, to create political space to maneuver?
Well, not really. There's always a possibility the Democrats stage some kind of big walkout to deny the Senate quorum. They all leave or they all hide in some foreign country. We kind of saw a version of this in Wisconsin years ago when the state Senate, when Democrats rushed out, so they denied quorum to the Republican majority. I don't think that Senate Democrats are eager to play those games. I think Senate Democrats recognize that they're in a kind of tight spot here. They forced Republicans to nuke the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees last year during the confirmation battle over Neil Gorsuch. So Republicans only need 50 votes plus a tiebreaker in Mike Pence. They seem to have a clear path to 50 votes. And all Democrats can do is kind of complain and yell and vote no. But even there, I think that red state Democrats, people like Heidi Heitkamp, Joe Donnelly, Manchin in West Virginia, they are probably going to end up voting for Kavanaugh because they don't want to be seen as resistance fighters who oppose everything Trump does. Most Americans don't pay close attention to these battles, and most Americans probably don't want their senators to be obstructionists, which is how Republicans will paint every single Democrat who votes against Kavanaugh. If you're a Democrat in the Senate right now, you've got a very, very limited playbook, and it's mostly limited to complaining on live TV about Kavanaugh's record.
Well, but of course, part of how we got to this situation is Americans not paying close enough attention to who the members of the various courts are, from local to state to federal. And hopefully, at least one of the things that can be achieved through this process is greater attention being paid by elected officials to explaining to the public the extreme significance of who these appointments are.
Yes, I certainly agree that all Americans need to pay a great deal more attention to judges on every single level, from the state judiciaries up through the lower federal courts and all the way up to the Supreme Court. And I hope that in the 2018 midterms, voters express their discontent with some of Trump's nominees to the federal judiciary, many of whom are objectively unqualified, some of whom have histories as anti-gay bloggers, as provocateurs who spread conspiracy theories about where Barack Obama was born. I mean, Trump has appointed a lot of really bad people to the lower federal courts. And I hope Americans pay more attention to that. But I'm not sure Kavanaugh is going to be the tipping point that makes Americans start really focusing on their courts, because he is this kind of pleasant-seeming, jocular, straight white dude. He kind of looks like a judge if you have a stereotypical image of what one is. And I don't think he's going to come across as arrogant the way that Gorsuch did. I think he's going to sell himself very well as a moderate with respect for precedent. And I think this is going to be a kind of sleeper nomination where he goes through pretty easily. And once he starts doing real damage on the court, the 2018 midterms are over and he's been installed there for life.
All right. Mark Joseph Stern, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me on.